I just, well, in Vrindavan, before coming here, I was in Vrindavan, and I completed, over the visit, chapters 18 and 19 from Canto 1. And going back to early January, I decided that this year I want to sequentially discuss Canto 2. So what you're going to hear this evening is some discussion from Canto 2, continuing where I left off. So I'll give you a little background so that you're up to speed where we take off. And just this morning I discussed from chapter 2 of Canto 2 up through text 12. We spent some time discussing text 12. And I gave a little simple overview of chapter 1 and a little bit of chapter 2. I'll do the same, only shorter version. In chapter 1, Shukadeva Goswami is instructing two things. He's instructing the principle of simplicity of lifestyle, of rejecting, consciously rejecting unnecessary comforts of life, the pursuit of happiness through material comforts of life, favoring instead a life of simplicity, taking what's necessary but in very simple manner. You could say, you know, renouncing the conception of material enjoyment means happiness, and accepting the conception of the existence of God. And especially for those that do not have a God conception, to see God within nature, that which your senses can perceive, to try to perceive God, how God is present within creation. So I detailed it this morning. I'm not going to do that again. And because there are many persons that just don't have a clear God conception. So chapter 2 goes one more step. Again, two messages, strong message on renunciation. Nivritti. You know the meaning? Everyone knows. So if I call on you, you'll be able to define it, right? What does nivritti mean? What is the meaning? Does anyone not know what nivritti means? Because if you don't raise your hand, I may call on you. Okay, thank you. Nivritti means a number of things, but in general it means elimination of material conception. Pravritti is the path of karmakanda, progressive material enjoyment. There's some level of enjoyment people have by following the ritualistic message and procedures within the Vedas. The standard of material enjoyment can be enhanced in this life and in the next life. The path of progressive material enjoyment. Nivritti is the path of progressive material detachment. As you go along the path of Nivritti Marg, the idea is to, like a pan scale, simultaneously diminish one's involvement in the affairs of material existence and simultaneously increase one's attraction for the supreme goal of life. Attachment for the supreme, detachment from matter. And it's not all at once, it's a progressive, gradual nivritti, detaching oneself from material involvement. That's where this simplicity idea comes. There's some necessities. Necessities, fine, but keep it simple. And as you go along, try to make it more simple. Whatever you need so that you're not in an artificial position of renunciation, but you're wishing to keep it simple. And simultaneously focusing your attention upon the Supreme. Investing consciousness there, withdrawing consciousness from the other side. Nivritti. So, in conjunction with this nivritti, another topic is mentioned. That's the topic of meditation upon the spiritual form of the Lord in the heart. It's the title of the chapter, Lord in the Heart. The seeing of God within nature is not spiritual. It's the universal form that's temporary, and things that are temporary are not spiritual or not eternal, not of spiritual substance. Nonetheless, the universal form is a form of the Lord. It's a form that Arjuna asks to see, and Krishna shows it, and it's described in the first chapter of the second canto. It's a form of the Lord. In that sense, it's spiritual, but it's temporary because the cosmos is manifest and then not manifest. And then again manifest, so it's temporary and therefore not fully spiritual. It's not an eternal form of the Lord. Meditation upon Paramatma, Prabhupada explains, automatically brings about nivritti, because you bring your attention to that which is fully spiritual. By doing so, automatically you've withdrawn consciousness from things temporary. So that meditation upon Supersoul it includes the benefit to be derived from Gyan Yoga. The process of Gyan Yoga is through knowledge, through Gyan, to nurture Vairagya. This couplet, Gyan Vairagya, comes repeatedly within the Vedas. Because the person who, both ways, the person who would like to develop Gyan should practice austerities or renunciation. Or when one develops knowledge of spirit distinct from matter, then understanding the relative merit of the two, one places much greater value in spirit. So one's value system for the temporary diminishes. Automatically that's included by this process of meditation, which ultimately is a step of devotion. So Prabhupada is explaining in meditation on the Supersoul, the form of the Lord in the heart, nivritti is essential. If you want to do meditation, you have to have control of the mind. It's kind of implicit. You've got to fix the mind on something, there must be control of the mind to not go to other somethings. And the chief something that agitates the mind more than anything else is sex agitation. Prabhupada describes that in this chapter and the previous chapter, when discussing Nivritti, the keep it simple instructions, Shukadeva Goswami has instructions for simplicity in matters of sleeping and defense and eating. Keep it simple. But he doesn't have a way of simplifying mating. It's just do without it. Unless it's specifically for a God-conscious purpose. So, for student life, tapasya brahmacharjena, samena cha dhamena cha tyagena satya shochabhyam yamena niyamena va. So this verse from the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada calls this the regulative principles of knowledge. It's where he's holding up, Shukadeva Goswami is presenting for Maharishi Parikshit the importance of having knowledge for refraining from sinful activities. The conclusion is that knowledge alone is not enough, but knowledge does help guide your activities away from the side of what's inappropriate and towards the side of what should be done, what's appropriate and inappropriate, what is dharma and what is adharma. And it certainly helps to have an idea what is dharma, to perform dharma and to stay away from adharma. It's not a certainty that you know and you still may do the wrong thing. So there should be some understanding of, for student life, what the importance of properly maintaining celibacy. What is the benefit of that? Why? The mind can become focused when it's not agitated towards sense enjoyment. Conversely, when the mind is agitated towards sense enjoyment, the mind cannot be focused on acquiring knowledge, and especially when it comes to subtle subject matters. The mind's agitated. You can't discern anything subtle because the mind's too agitated. Some things that are obvious, you can discern them. And there's no stronger pulling force for material enjoyment than male-female attraction and enjoying spirit. It's very disruptive for student life. And therefore, student life should be carefully conducted in the manners of celibacy. And when student life is completed, then there can be consideration of entering into household life or not. So that's a little background. This previous purport was simply on this one point, or 90% on this one point, of the importance of controlling sex desire in the process of meditation. If one is attempting meditation but contemplating sex desire, sex enjoyment, that's not meditation on the Lord in the heart, it's meditation on something else. It's not going to lead to spiritual elevation or purity. Okay, so now text 13. The process of meditation should begin from the lotus feet of the Lord and progress to His smiling face. The meditation should be concentrated upon the lotus feet, then the calves, then come to the thighs, then in this way higher and higher. The more the mind becomes fixed upon the different parts of the limbs, one after another, the more the intelligence becomes purified. So Prabhupada has explained that the first two cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam, they're the lotus feet. Just as with the form of the Lord, the literary form of the Lord has its different parts, bodily limbs. And before progressing to the next limb, one's concentration should be effective and strong. What Prabhupada has said is that one should have assimilated the message of the first two cantos before going further. Like a meditation upon the form of the Lord should begin at His feet and proceed up one by one. Since it is recommended in this verse that one should gradually progress from the lotus feet up to the smiling face, we shall not jump at once to understand the Lord's pastimes in the rasa dance in the 10th canto. It is better to practice concentrating our attention by offering flowers and tulsi to the lotus feet of the Lord. In this way we gradually become purified by the archana process. So worship is part of this hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam progressively. We dress the Lord, bathe Him, etc. And all these transcendental activities help us purify our existence. When we reach the higher standard of purification, if we see the smiling face of the Lord or hear the rasa dance pastimes of the Lord, then we can relish His activities. Those who are too engrossed in sense gratification cannot be allowed to participate in archana or to touch the transcendental form of Radha, Krishna, or Vishnu deities. For them it is better to meditate on the gigantic Virat Rupa of the Lord, as recommended in the next verse. The Virat Rupa was from chapter 1 of this canto. Now, this is here in this second canto because it's the subject of second canto. It's not a theme that Prabhupada consistently in all of his teachings presented. Meditate on the universal form of the Lord. The emphasis is that one should go progressively, slowly, step by step, and not try to jump to prematurely to some elevated position. And in that unqualified state, just make a mess of things. Because impersonalists and the voidists are not sufficiently purified in their spiritual activities, archana is not meant for them. Now, having said that, it's also a fact that most elevated Paramahansas, they worship deities as well. Madhavendra Puri was able to see Krishna. Krishna came to see him. Krishna came to give him something, a pot of milk. Later, Krishna gave him, in his deity form, a pot of sweet rice. So he was a very elevated Vaishnava. But he became very dedicated to the worship of his deity, Gopal. Or each of the six Goswamis in Vrindavan, they worshipped deities. And it wasn't just to set example, they were very attached to their deity worship. In fact, the deity was attached to them. The deity disclosed, "I want to be worshipped by you, Madan Mohan." Deity told the pujari, told his servant pujari, "A mendicant is going to come tomorrow, and I want to be worshipped by him." And when Sanatana Goswami came, he said, "My deity wants to go with you. He told me. How can I worship him? I'm a mendicant. I don't have anything." But so, deity worship is there to assist on both ends. To enhance one's personal conception of God in the beginning stages, as with the impersonalist, or those that have such tendency, or a materialist, to offer wonderful things to God instead of for one's own enjoyment. And on the topmost stages. Text 14. Unless the gross materialist develops a sense of loving service unto the Supreme Lord, who is the seer of both the transcendental and material worlds, he should remember or meditate upon the universal form of the Lord at the end of his prescribed duties. So once again, this is that message of fixing the mind upon the Supreme Lord. Manmana bhavamad bhakto, or ananyas chintayanto mam. Fixing one's mind upon the Supreme is essential. Whatever the stage may be, it's a principle that is very important. So, the verse is mentioning, it's before and after, and ideally throughout, but minimally, just in a practicing way. One meditates upon your master, your Ishtadev. And if one isn't elevated enough to have that spiritual conception, then at least the universal form conception. So the performance of duties that are properly done, but without mindfulness of the Supreme, according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's useless. Useless in the sense of transcendental realization. The mode of goodness is good. We're just listening to Prabhupada explain this at a lecture in New Vrindavan. Religion is to help people come to the mode of goodness. But what's the purpose of the mode of goodness? The purpose of the mode of goodness, it brings you to the threshold of the kingdom of God. But if you come to the threshold and you don't go through the doorway, might as well be somewhere else in the house besides us at the threshold of the doorway. It's really non-different. Because the purpose is to go through the door into the spiritual side. So religion that teaches goodness without God consciousness, it's misleading. And very quickly, the standard of what is considered to be goodness, that will also deteriorate, because unless the standard is God-given standard, it's a man-given standard. And the time and the modes of nature, the time energy and the modes of nature, are going to change the configuration of what people think goodness is, if there's no standard. I'll present what I just said in the form of a question. I was asked by a young Indian, non-resident Indian, who was the top honors student in his graduating class for the whole state. And he graduated when he was 16. He graduated 3 years early, just because he was brilliant. He went to a school for brilliant people. And when I met him, he asked me this question. 16-year-old that's on his way for a full scholarship to a very prestigious university, said, how do I answer my friends' questions when they say, why are you a theist? They say to me, wouldn't it be better if you were an agnostic, an ethical agnostic? Why do you believe in God? You don't know that God exists, so it's more honest to say, you don't know. But you should be responsible for your actions, and so you should be ethical. So being an ethical agnostic is better. It's a more honest position than being an ethical theist. Tell me why you want to take this position of being a theist. I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, I know I want to be devoted to God, but I don't know how to answer their question. How do I answer the question? So there are many answers, but one answer is, if God just disappears from the picture, then the question remains, what is the standard of what is ethics? And today, what is unethical is tomorrow's ethics. The Vedas don't speak about abortion. So, because it was just something that couldn't even consider, that a woman would kill the child within her womb. How it's unconscionable to do such a thing. But today it's standard. And it's not just in the West. There's in North India, I read two different reports of this. There's an organization that travels around and they do sonograms. They have this medical technology that tells whether it's a boy or a girl. And when the woman finds out that it's a girl, the father and the mother, along with the sonogram program, is an abortion clinic. And some huge number of female children are being killed in the womb. So the ratio of men or young boys to young girls is now like 5 to 1, because so many female children are being killed in the womb right here in India. And then it becomes a problem for the men to have marriages to a proper girl, because they were killed before they even had a chance to protest. And so it's like, it's a business, using the technology of sonograms and the technology of abortions. But the Vedas never even addressed such a subject. It was an unthinkable subject. And, you know, the United States government spends tons of money over the legal dispute over abortion or not abortion. And there's so many things. So one of the answers that I gave to this young man was, if God is not there, what's the standard for what's ethical? Who's going to determine that? The modes of nature will determine that, whatever is prevalent at the time. Vox populi, as Prabhupada says, then man determines what's ethical. But you read in Mahabharata and so many other spiritual literature, scriptural literatures, the issue of determining what is to be done and what is not to be done is a major issue. And who is going to determine that? The other way around is to say, according to the Vedic scriptures, dharmam hi sakshat bhagavat pranitam, what is dharma is given by God. End of dialogue. If you don't have, so, in fact, what is to be done is established by God. What is ethical is given by God. And that's the standards by which we live. And if God disappears from the picture, anything goes. He said, that makes sense to me. I don't know about my friends. He said, try it and let me know how it comes out. One of my disciples is a school teacher, and the Board of Education did a study 15 years ago, what you had to do, what was the behavior that would be the cause for expulsion from the classroom. And today, what's the cause for expulsion from the classroom? And this was like maybe 10 years ago even. But if you spoke out of turn without raising your hand and being called on by the teacher, you could be expelled from the classroom. Or if you threw something across the room, you know, a paper airplane or a spit wad or something, you know, like a piece of paper that got you moistened, you expelled from the classroom. Or you talk back, the teacher says something, you talk back, the teacher can be expelled from the classroom. And today, if you're carrying a weapon, a lethal weapon, you can be expelled from the classroom. Or if you threaten the life of the teacher, right, say, I'm going to kill you, you can be expelled from the classroom. So, you know, what is unethical before, this today is just standard practice. And what today is unethical is tomorrow's standard practice. It's just the deterioration of Kali Yuga. Who's the one that's going to decide what's ethical? Like Prabhupada's statement of honor amongst thieves. The thieves go and steal something. And then they say, okay, now we should divide it up fairly. Honor amongst thieves. An equal amount to everybody. We have to be fair. It doesn't exist. It's a contradiction, inherent contradiction. For those that are averse to God, they're going to be ethical. It's not going to happen. So, meditation upon the personality of Godhead before, during, and after at least before and after, as in a religious way, that's necessary to maintain the standard of goodness and elevate one's character. So religious life involves elevation of goodness, but it won't endure without God consciousness. Therefore, the first step in God realization is to have a concept of God. And elevation of one's work requires applying that conception of God consciousness to one's duties of life. The real purpose of life is to make contact with the Lord and be engaged in His service. That is the natural position of living entities. But those who are impersonalists and are unable to render any loving service to the Lord have been advised to meditate upon His impersonal feature, the Virat Rupa, or universal form. Some way or other, one must reestablish one's forgotten relationship with the Lord if one at all desires to gain real happiness in life and to regain His unfettered condition. For the less intelligent beginners, meditation on the impersonal feature of Virat Rupa, universal form of the Lord, will gradually qualify one to rise to personal contact. So this personal contact beginning is the process of meditation, but not just meditation on nothingness or meditation on a mandala or a candle flame or a spot on the wall or an object of nature, but meditate on spiritual substance, on the form of the Lord within the heart, and that's detailed by Shukadeva Goswami in earlier verses of this chapter. So let's see if you have any questions or any discussion.
Maharaj, you are emphasizing that the meditation from lotus feet and going upward and systematic study. So, and you are mentioning that first canto refers to the lotus feet of the
first two cantos.
First two cantos refer to the lotus feet of the law. So, what will we imbibe principles when we hear from first canto in this regard? You are saying.
Say the first part of the sentence. What is the?
We are emphasizing that first two cantos refer to the realization of the lotus feet of the Lord.
That part I got. Then the question was.
Means we are hearing now first canto. From.
Yes.
Systematically we are hearing from first canto. So objective is that when we hear from first canto, what is the essential realization?
Mood of service. Your question is, you want an essence, so that's the essence. Mood of service is the essence. The mood of humble service. Because when you approach, approaching the lotus feet of the Lord means humble service. Devoid of upadis, material conceptions of self. The rejection of material conceptions, the acceptance of spiritual conception of who I am, what is my duty, who is my master. And in the mood of service, be at the feet of the Lord, eager for any indication of service. That's the essence. So then there's many details that spring from that essence. Service that's not motivated. Service to the Supreme and not other. Ananya Bhak. Service with the right motivation. What's the distinction between service with motivation and service with no motivation? No, selfish motivation. Those things are discussed. But the essence is, if one has carefully studied the assimilation of the message of the first canto, is to be in a mood of humble service. Just waiting for some indication of the Lord's desire and then proceed. So it's not just information, and it's not just conceptual. It's a way of life, being situated in that consciousness of wanting to serve the Supreme Lord favorably. Anything? Well, there's many things, but what comes to mind readily is anukoyasya sankalpa pratikoyasya varjanam, that there's to knowing the mind's tendency to go to the lazy position. The default mode is laziness, and the attentive mode takes some effort, at least in our present stage. So renew again and again and again and again the spiritual conception of what Vaishnava Sangha means. Like with anything else, like with chanting, like with worship. One can take these things in an ordinary way. So by the process of hearing, then one can be again and again reminded of the spiritual conception of what association is, what worship is, what the holy name is. So, in one word, it's education. Rededicate ourselves to the spiritual education and training that we're receiving, to spiritualize the conceptions and eliminate the material conceptions. I'm saying two things at the front end of my answer. One is, renew your commitment to the spiritual conception of what Vaishnava association is. And the downside is, avoid the complacency mode. The just going forward with dull thinking, and that means material conceptions. Beware of the default mode of complacency. Another thing is you can, if you're tuned in to what's happening with your consciousness, that if you're not just in a mechanical mode, but in the cultivation of Krishna consciousness mode, you can very easily, like instantly, detect what you're feeling. If you're feeling, there's a transcendental joy from serving Krishna that just isn't there when you're just working, doing activities mindlessly. That's a subjective way of checking and progressing. When there's a spiritual disconnect, you'll feel it. Vice versa, when there's a spiritual connect, you feel it. This is right. So, a third answer is an answer that you could supply yourself, most likely, because it's something that you're all very carefully trained in. And that is, just like this example given here, you're naturally going to be more respectful to the person who is your teacher than to those who are not your teacher. Just being, you know, somewhat cultured persons, you know, totally uncultured persons, they don't care. But where there's a little bit of culture, that respect for teacher will help build respect for those who are also students of a teacher. Follow? And a even bigger scale, a broader scale, to be respectful to all living entities for that stage of Krishna consciousness to unfold, one has to have enormous amount of respect for those who are intimately associated with the Lord. Go the other direction. If I do have great respect for the intimate association, I have great respect for those who have intimate association with the Supreme Lord. That's going to elevate my consciousness to the position where I will be respectful in my dealings with all. If that connection is missing, being respectful to other living entities is going to be a big struggle. So strengthen your relationship with those that are chaining and guiding you in spiritual life. And that will automatically enhance the respectful dealings that you have towards Vaishnavas. Got it? A fourth answer is that just by overall purification, as one becomes elevated more in the mode of goodness and away from passion and ignorance, the mode of goodness quality in general will help to support respect, because that's also a quality of goodness. If my whole life is surrounded with an atmosphere of goodness, it'll help in the respect department also. Because it's a quality of goodness also. Another answer is, Prabhupada taught us in ashram life that at least the beginning of each day, when we see another devotee in the temple, we should offer our obeisances. So devotees that were trained by Prabhupada directly in that way, that's a practice. Every day. Every day. Every day. You see one another, first thing, you pay obeisances. It's like children paying their obeisances to their parents. You know, in modern days people don't do that, but in Vaishnava families, their Vaishnava children are trained to do that. The wife pays her obeisances when seeing her husband. The devotees in general pay obeisances when they see a sannyasi. It's just it's an expression, a behavior. It's just a behavior. It's not consciousness. It's just a behavior. But it helps cultivate respect. It can become a ritual, and that it's the effect is diminished. But if one is conscious of the purpose for that culture, that cultural gesture, then it helps to promote respect. By offering respects in a formal way. Another example of that one is Prabhupada taught us to address one another as Prabhu. And it's you know, with a purpose that here's I'm the servant and this is my master. We say Prabhu to the other Vaishnava because so and so Prabhu is my Prabhu. Now when it becomes mechanical, we just say so-and-so Prabhu. We're not thinking my master, that's just their name, the name by which we address them. Then respect is neutralized. But if we're mindful of that gesture or external behavior of speech or action by paying obeisances, then it helps promote respect. And a short answer is there's no substitute for Krishna consciousness. When there's Krishna consciousness, automatically there's respect. Anything else?
Yes. I am interested in the importance of mind control. And that mind, we cannot control mind if it is agitated by senses. So, although we have the greatest opportunity to hear about it from 70 persons, or to sufferings of self gratification and importance of mind control. But momentarily our mind got agitated and senses become just wild. So where is the wrong that one is going while this one is trying to cultivate relationship with the preceptor?
Based upon the premise of your question, the answer would be it's just residual effect of past material contact, like the blades of the fan that continue to spin even after pulling the plug. That the blades of fan continue to spin is not a surprise. The main thing is, don't go put the plug back in again. Don't be surprised or disturbed by residual tendencies. You tolerate them because it's due to past involvement with material energy in a mood of enjoyment. So just don't go back there again. Don't plug in again. And that residual tendency will subside. That's a short answer. Something?
Is it, you told that we have to be conscious about that. So the consciousness is that we have to develop respect, or the consciousness is being grateful of what we are receiving. What is that consciousness?
Why separate the two? Where there's gratitude, isn't there also respect? Where there's respect, isn't there also gratitude? They're not identical, but they're simultaneous. And, you know, the agent that will destroy them both is pride. When one is grateful, there's recognition that I've been given this wonderful gift. And if I'm not thinking with a grateful heart of where this gift has come from, I just take the gift and I'm proud that I have this gift. I'm not thinking of this gift, it's mine, this thing. It's mine. So Trajit was awarded the Shamantaka jewel. He became proud. And his behavior as in that, under the influence of pride, was very strong. But Krishna wanted to relieve him of that pride. So he just very humbly asked him for the jewel. And asked, give it to the king. Can you give it to Ugrasena? So Trajit refused. Krishna didn't want the jewel. Krishna wanted his heart to be freed from pride. Later on, after Trajit fabricated a story that and spread it around that Krishna had killed his brother to get the jewel, and it was proven wrong, He was both afraid what the Yadus might do to him, and he was concerned about his own reputation. So he gave Krishna the jewel and his daughter. Krishna accepted the jewel and gave the jewel back, with the understanding he didn't really want to give it to me. I don't need the jewel. So now Sutrajit's his father-in-law, and he lost his life because of the offense that he had made to Krishna. I mean, that was the consequence of offending the Supreme Lord. So what I'm saying here is that pride destroys gratitude. They're opposites, and respect as well. how can I be respectful of someone who I don't have proper regard for? Because there's pride in my heart. So, one who is moved by the forces of false egoism isn't going to be respectful. It isn't going to be grateful. Let's say, I want to be respectful for all the devotees because they're sent by Krishna to help elevate me. My failure to respect them is based upon my failure to respect Krishna. If I'm feeling envy or enmity towards another, it's envy or enmity towards Krishna. Or another way of saying the same thing is there's no substitute for Krishna consciousness. If I have a very strong conscious desire that I want to re-establish my loving relationship with Krishna, even maybe struggling with some of this other stuff, that will carry me to a stronger position to deal with that stuff and to be on the other side of it. Krishna wants our loving. Krishna wants our love and our loving relationship. Hundreds of times more than we do. But he doesn't interfere. He'll give us reminders, but he doesn't interfere. He'll encourage us, but he doesn't interfere. He'll give us lessons that minus that loving relationship, it's hellish. But he doesn't interfere. We just have to stay, you get the message, stay fixed in that purpose. And one of the primary resources that Krishna sends as one of his gifts that one can feel gratitude to Krishna for is he'll send confidential associates or those that are our teachers and guides and instructors. That's coming from Krishna. Every one of us at some point had some keen desire. I want something more than just this material thing. There surely must be something more than this. Everyone, in different ways, that desire or thought has been that which led us to Krishna consciousness. And then there's someone that Krishna sends to help us. Maharaj Pariksit was cursed to die. He dedicated himself to Krishna. Krishna sent the sages. Krishna sent Shukadeva Goswami. Krishna sent all resources. Krishna will send all resources. Everything that we need to reach him. Ananyas chintayantamam yejana paripasate tesham nityabhi yuktanam. Yoga kshema vahamyam. So part of what Krishna provides, which we're lacking, is proper intelligence, how to reach him. And that's what's spiritual teachers are for. So again, like devotee association, and specifically a teacher devotee, these are resources that Krishna is sending to reciprocate with our prayer to Him, our calling out to Him, I want a relationship with you. More than just the things of this world, I want that. Krishna sent the resources to take you there. The Dhammi Buddhi Yogam Tham, Yenamam Upi Yantite. The gist of what I'm saying here is that the things that we need to do, the do's and the don'ts, have a purpose behind them, a framework, and that is to become Krishna conscious. It's Krishna's assistance, this, that, and combination of things is to assist us, all the essence and purpose behind it all is to become established in our loving relationship with Krishna. So see those things in that context. Then we're protected. The other way around, do all those things without understanding the purpose behind them, you won't get the fruit. Even chanting the holy names for millions of lifetimes, one will not get the fruit. As long as things are perceived in an ordinary way, the holy name and the devotees and the scripture and deity and process. It's not a process of piety, it's a process of transcendence. See the holy name as a pious act, as an offense to the holy name. To see the devotees of the Lord as ordinary good people, it's an offense. That they're, in one sense, we're all ordinary, but by contact with devotional service, that which is otherwise ordinary becomes elevated to another position. That's the process of bhakti, and we're part of that process. So the process is glorious, although we're quite ordinary. And that's where the respect needs to go. And then the ordinary becomes extraordinary. Ourselves included, if we have that consciousness. Or cultivate Krishna consciousness. It's not a matter of a mental adjustment, it's a matter of fact. The Supreme Lord and His holy name are non-different, and we chant His holy name, our existence becomes uplifted and spiritualized. And those that are doing the same, they're agents of the same. And those that are teachers of that process, they're in a very special position. Krishna's words in Bhagavad Gita indicate, for those who do teach us imperishable science, there's no one more dear to me than He. It's not a bluff. That's how Krishna feels towards such a person. Therefore, we should respect. And that respect is part of our relationship with Krishna. If that respect is missing, it says something about our relationship with Krishna. It's all for that purpose. It's all part of Krishna. A grand orchestration Krishna is making to take us to Him. Okay? Anything else? Okay. Srila Prabhupada, please.
Yeah.